This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
At a city level, policies like congestion pricing, if they're not implemented correctly, the effect they have on everyday citizens is that the feeling that government is not on their side, but on their backs. Because if someone's trying to make ends meet, the idea of paying extra for a green ideal isn't compelling to them.
They say the squeaky wheel gets the grease. Well, this week on Sea Change Radio, we speak to two brothers who are trying to make a little noise for the issues they care about through citizen journalism. Eric and Joshua Previn put out a weekly publication, The Previn Report, from their hometown of Los Angeles. We discuss the issue of congestion pricing, a proposal to reduce traffic currently being considered by local government there. Then we dip into the Sea Change Radio archives and hear from Rawa Gurmatsian, the executive director of Push Buffalo, to learn about her organization's efforts to make Buffalo, New York greener while also helping communities of color.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by the co-founders of the Previn Report. Old friends of mine, Eric Previn and Joshua Previn. They are open government advocates, watchdog journalists. Joshua, Eric, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Alex. Good to be on.
It's a pleasure to have you guys. Why don't you first tell our listeners in a nutshell, either one of you, what the mission of the Previn Report is?
Thanks. This is Joshua. The mission of the Previn Report is to advocate for more transparent government in Los Angeles City and County.
And why don't you give some examples of some of your work in action?
Well, we write a weekly column that is basically a watchdog column, which covers many, many different issues, ranging from what's kind of garden variety government corruption to broader issues. Recently, that's had to do with the Brown Act and the city of Los Angeles violating laws to do with open meetings.
So, Eric, you recently were speaking at a meeting of the LA County Metro Board, LACMTA. I'll let you explain exactly what that is. And the issue of congestion pricing came up, and it's something that we've discussed on Sea Change Radio before, and I wanted to get your thoughts in a minute. First, what exactly is the LA County Metro Board?
Sure. The Metro Board is comprised of local officials like from around the region, including the mayor of Long Beach, the mayor of Los Angeles, and the mayor of Glendale. You know, all these communities send their designee to this group of about 15 elected officials who control the region's metropolitan authority budget, which includes transit authority budget, which is a much larger budget than either the county or the city of LA alone, and really is intended to maintain and implement the infrastructure requirements for the city and county.
And for listeners around the country who aren't familiar with the idea of congestion pricing, which has not been implemented yet in Los Angeles, but it's being discussed, what exactly are we talking about when we talk about congestion pricing?
It means different things in different cities around the world, but specifically in Los Angeles, it means one of two things: either charging people per mile to drive in certain roads at certain times, actually three things, or charging people to enter a certain region of the city, and finally, paying a surcharge when they use Uber or Lyft. And the goal of it is to reduce traffic.
And it's been pretty successful in cities like London, I believe, correct?
Yes, but an important difference between London and Los Angeles is that London is quite centralized, whereas Los Angeles is famously decentralized. It has lots of pockets of the city's, you know, broken up into areas.
Right. So that was why I originally was, when I was reading proposals for this to happen in Los Angeles, which would be pretty cutting edge in terms of United States policy. I was thinking, I would love to see this in LA someday, but I don't see Los Angeles as being the low-hanging fruit for congestion pricing for a number of reasons. Maybe you can elaborate.
Right. Well, first of all, LA is kind of the iconic car culture metropolis of LA. So people have, there's a long tradition of people wanting to be able to drive their cars. Also, it wasn't planned with public transit in mind. It evolved through the use of cars. So public transport, you know, unlike, say, in Manhattan, which works well with subways and stuff, LA City, it doesn't work so well because there's this last half mile problem. It's very hard to get exactly where you want to go. You can get within a mile if you take a bus or a subway, but most people aren't willing to walk a mile, or they may not be able to because they have equipment. Obviously, they've tried this in all over the world. The closest they've come in the United States is in New York, but that's famously failed as well.
And then the thing that kind of really stuck in my mind when I thought of Los Angeles is, although I haven't lived there since the explosion of the Ubers and the Lyfts, they've been working on a lot of infrastructure to upgrade public transportation, but it is nothing compared to a New York in terms of its subway system, right?
Correct.
And so, Eric, when I saw a video of you discussing the issue in front of the LA County Metro Board, you were thinking of that very scenario of somebody on the lower income side of the spectrum being punished essentially by congestion pricing. Why don't you talk about how it could affect the metropolitan area's most vulnerable populations?
Sure. You know, one of the biggest problems with the kind of gentrification of lots of the nicer parts of Los Angeles, I suppose you'd say, is that the people who work there have to travel in from rather significant distances because the affordable housing stock is very low in those places. So what you would see typically is someone driving in from outside the main part of, let's say, where I live in Studio City, and coming by bus or metro or driving from San Bernardino sometimes or someplace quite far away. And so those are the people who need to bring their supplies and their cars and are going to feel the impact of charging to use the public roadways, certainly more than somebody who's able to live in close to the town and take advantage of some of the existing connectors that we have.
I would add that the way congestion pricing works is by obviously making it somewhat prohibitively expensive to use the roads at certain times. But what's prohibitively expensive for someone of modest means is really a drop in the bucket for someone who's wealthy. So in effect, the actual on-the-ground effect of congestion pricing is that wealthy people are, you know, usually happy because the roads are cleared for them and they don't care about the extra price, and people who can't afford it are the ones who are punished.
So in essence, it's a regressive tax of sorts.
Yes, it's a regressive tax, and it affects, you know, people in surprising ways from an environmental point of view. For example, farmers markets, including organic farms, those people have to drive a considerable distance to bring their goods to market. And so, perversely, you have those people being punished by a policy that's designed to promote a greener city.
And that's the thing, that everybody kind of wants the same outcome. We want greener cities. It's just a question of how to get there. But in terms of ways to reduce traffic, what kind of incentive systems do you think might work better than a congestion pricing model?
Well, one example would be to make the bus system safer and therefore more desirable to be used. In Los Angeles, there's a real problem that even the bus drivers themselves don't feel safe. And one possible solution to that would be to have a security personnel, you know, on buses that are in certain areas. And that would be what we've talked to people that, you know, actually use the bus. And that would be something that could really make a difference. What happened instead is that the Los Angeles Police Department was given a big contract to have their officers work overtime and not to be on the individual buses, but to kind of congregate in the actual, you know, but in the bus station. So that's a huge amount of money that could have been better deployed, making buses more usable.
Alex, I have another solution that, you know, arises out of the quick sort of fantasy of what it's like on a day when we're not in the worst congestion in the middle of the week. Something like, although it's true in some of our freeways, even on the weekend, it can be jammed like crazy. But on a typical like Monday holiday, traffic is light and you can sail right through. It's like, wow. It's sort of a throwback to the way it used to be before there were so many of us. But I think going forward, and I think that people have talked about the idea of incentivizing large employers to get people to work from home on a certain number of days a week is a very promising area, because I feel like a lot of jobs, not all the jobs, but a lot of jobs now, given technology and, you know, the kinds of, whether it be Skype or other platforms, if people were encouraged to skip a few days out of the month, you could see how it might impact the overall flow. Now, the service employees who have to be there, you know, to physically do their jobs, would be enjoying less congestion, is the answer of how it would impact them.
And they're the people who can least afford to pay for congestion pricing. But
exactly.
So the people who wouldn't feel the pain in their wallets of a congestion pricing model would be the people who could stay home in a telecommuting scenario anyway.
Yeah, I mean, my point is that you would be enjoying the benefit of having the person off the road who could work at home a couple days a week, let's say. They would be enjoying the benefit of being able to work in their undies, which I think is everybody's dream, ultimately, Yeah. And
that's,
finally,
that's
I think
the dream, work in your undies.
And you're good at citing studies, certainly better than I am, but I'm pretty convinced that study after study has shown that against all odds, because of the incredible procrastinations we're all capable of, productivity goes up when people work at home.
People can be more productive, and they also, and there's a lot of benefits to their parenting and helping as a partner in the home as well.
Exactly. And a promising idea, but one that is complicated in addition to Uber and Lyft, is the scooters that have popped up in jurisdictions around LA, like Lime. And you probably have seen this as well.
Yeah, we actually just did a piece on them, on the electric scooters.
Well, I'll stay in my lane in that case, but I just wanted to mention that that's happening in our neighborhood, and it has predictably provoked some discussion. You know, people are worried about injuries, you know, because it is, you're very unprotected on a scooter.
And you're supposed to wear a helmet, and pretty much no one does.
Exactly, exactly.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to the co-founders of the Previn Report, Joshua Previn and Eric Previn. So maybe you can kind of give us a status update on where the metropolitan area stands in terms of adopting such a thing. It's just been the last couple months that it's been getting heard in front of the LA County Metro Board and other local boards. Los Angeles is getting itchy to make a move and rid itself of the reputation of being the nation's traffic capital, particularly in light of the 2028 Olympics coming to the city. Where do proposals stand right now, and what should we expect on the horizon in terms of whether it's adopted or not?
Well, at the last Metro Board meeting that we talked about in February, they asked for a report back in, I believe, 90 days or 6 months at the various options to consider congestion pricing. And Joshua and I were discussing earlier the context of this initially being rolled out in the package of 28 projects to accomplish the 2028 Olympics. And they were looking at projects that they could accelerate and such. Subsequent to the outpouring of questions about congestion pricing, it looks to us as if they've decoupled the idea of the discussion of congestion pricing taking place in the context of the Olympics. So long story short is they're moving forward with studies of every possible way to do congestion pricing with a big consideration for equity, which caused us to wonder whether or not hanging a banner of equity undoes the essential problems with how it disproportionately impacts the people we've been talking about.
So they're going to do a study, which will take they'll take a year or two, and they will report back on a few options. The first option is for people to be charged by the mile that they drive. The second option would be to be charged by entering into a zone, certain city center zones. And the third option would be paying a tax when you use Uber or Lyft, or some combination of the three.
So this congestion pricing issue in Los Angeles, has it had reverberations on the federal level?
Well, I'm not sure if it's had reverberations on the federal level, but I think that it's the issue is kind of a microcosm of an issue that I think affects national politics, and in particular, the Green New Deal and efforts to, you know, beat Trump in 2020. And the reason is that at a city level, policies like congestion pricing, which have idealistic goals related to the environment, if they're not implemented correctly, the effect they have on everyday citizens is that the feeling that government is not on their side, but on their backs. Because if someone's trying to make ends meet, the idea of paying extra for a green ideal isn't compelling to them. So I think it's just a reality that's going to have to be dealt with.
Well, it's good to know that you guys are out there fighting the good fight. Joshua and Eric Previn, thanks so much for being my guests on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex.
Thanks, Alex.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by the Deputy Director of Push Buffalo, Rawa Gramatsian. Rawa, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you for having me on your show.
So Push Buffalo, PUSH stands for People United for Sustainable Housing. What is the mission of your organization?
So PUSH Buffalo is a local membership-based organization that works in community development that's fighting to make affordable housing a reality on Buffalo's west side. Our mission is to mobilize residents to create a strong neighborhood with quality, affordable housing, to expand local hiring opportunities, and to advance economic justice in Buffalo.
And maybe you can give us an example of your work in action.
Sure. So PUSH really does a lot of things. We have a justice side, which means we organize. So we have a whole organizing department that has several different campaigns it runs. And so we also effectively work on policy, both at the state level and local level. But what I think sets PUSH Buffalo apart from other organizations is we take all of those organizing wins and translate them to community development and economic development opportunities in our 25 square block area that we call PUSH's Green Development Zone, or GDZ. So the GDZ was founded in 2008, and it combines green affordable housing construction, community-based renewable energy projects, housing weatherization, green jobs training, green infrastructure, and vacant land restoration, all towards the goal of creating pathways to employment for neighborhood residents and reduce our carbon footprint.
And you came from Eritrea as a girl. Can you explain how your childhood as an immigrant to Buffalo informs your work now?
I actually was born in the middle of a civil war in Eritrea and came to Buffalo, New York by way of Sudan. And how it informs my work is that I was in the first wave of immigrants and refugees. So I've been in Buffalo for about 32 years, and I lived in this neighborhood for most of it. And what's interesting is about 15, 20 years ago, Buffalo became the second highest resettled city in America. Our immigrants and refugees come from all over the world. At the Grant Street Neighborhood Center, which is right here at PUSH's headquarters, where we run an after-school drop-in center for youth, I would say about 80 to 90% of our youth are immigrants, refugees, and about 40 different languages are spoken here. And if you go up and down, you know, Grant Street, you can hear up to 60 languages being spoken. And I think how, I think being an immigrant and refugee really does inform my work. First, I think that PUSH Buffalo is the kind of organization that is run by people that are of and from the community. They are dedicated to investing in leadership, especially for women and minorities. And so I think that being the deputy director really does help because of the neighborhood that we work in and the folks that we serve. But also, I think I have a pretty good understanding of what some of the challenges and barriers are for our recent Americans.
And why don't you explain some of the challenges you face as a city that's cold and relatively poor?
Yeah, so Buffalo, New York, in its heyday, you may know this, Alex, was the sixth largest economy in the country. But around 1970, we'd pretty much lost half of our population, half of our industry that was based on steel and the...
And your basketball team.
And the basketball team. I didn't even know anything about that, actually.
The Braves, Buffalo
I didn't know
Braves.
That Buffalo ever had.
They became the Los Angeles Clippers today.
Oh,
the San
wow.
Diego Clippers, who were the Los Angeles Clippers, were the Buffalo Braves until things started going downhill. But I digress. Go on. Sorry.
Absolutely. And so what we have is we are the third poorest city behind, trailing behind Detroit and Cleveland. And so we have a lot of challenges there. We also have pretty high unemployment rates, especially within African-American and Latino populations. In the African-American community, we have about a 32.5% unemployment. But if you dig a little bit deeper, if you look at the employable African-American male population ages 18 to 64, an independent study showed that it's really 57%. When you look at the Latino community, it's about 27.5% unemployment. And a lot of the people that do work in Buffalo within the urban core in minority communities are actually considered the working poor. They work minimum wage jobs in the service industry. And so, you know, in the area that we selected, the Green Development Zone, 12 years ago, it was one of the poorest communities in the country, where an average family of four, their annual income was somewhere between $10,000 and $12,000 a year.
And the cold weather in Buffalo must affect how you plan both short-term and long-term. Maybe you can speak towards that.
Yes. So in the short term, we are trying to help all of the homeowners or the people that are living in homes that, you know, are architecturally beautiful and sound. Unfortunately, they were built before insulation. So you can imagine the utility prices of our homeowners and people and renters. Also, many of the homes have lead paint and high rates of asbestos. So these homes are making people sick and keeping them poor. So that is how we actually started running our Push Green program, which weatherizes people's homes. We've weatherized over 500 people's homes within the Buffalo community and helped about 1,000 homes get weatherized altogether. The reason why we got into affordable housing is because, you know, most people pay more for their utility bill than they do for their rent. So we have about 84 apartments within the green development zone, ranging in 1 to 4 bedrooms that is green and efficient, including a net zero house, which I don't know if you know what a net zero house is, but it nets zero, means that on an annualized basis, it consumes as much energy as it produces. And what's great about this little net zero house that we have, it's in a low-income community. We think it's the only one of its kind. Most net zeros that are being built are actually new homes. If you go, for example, to very progressive nations like Germany, you know, every new home that they build is actually net zero now. But in Buffalo, New York, it's somewhat of a demonstration site. And so it was also a training house. We were able to train about 43 men and women from our neighborhood in building a net zero house using the latest green technology.
But that's kind of the shining example. What are, for example, how much do some of these needy or recipients of your work, how much does it take a chunk out of their utility bills usually?
Right. So I would say if you are, say, living in a two-bedroom house, especially before 2008, now the housing market is very quickly appreciating in Buffalo. We're the seventh fastest growing housing market in the country. If you would have told me 5 years ago we would be introducing inclusionary zoning policy at the Common Council, I would have told you you're crazy. We have other big challenges to worry about, not gentrification. That is very quickly becoming a big problem for us. So we have actually introduced inclusionary zoning policy at the city level. However, most of our folks, if they were living in a 2 to 3 bedroom house, which is pretty common here in Buffalo, they were paying about, you know, a little over $500 a month to $600 and upward, sometimes $800 a month in utilities.
Wow.
Whereas they were probably paying about $450 to $550 a month in rent.
That's stunning.
Yes, it is stunning. So, for that same 2 to 3 bedroom apartment in one of our housing, you're going to pay anywhere between $450 to $550 a month, but you're only going to be paying about $85 to $100 a month in utilities. So significant savings.
She's the deputy director of Push Buffalo, Rawa Gurmatsian. Rawa, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Alex, thank you so much for having me.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Digga Rhythm Band, Talking Heads, and Jimmy Reed. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.